Hello, it's 10:30. It's time to start our 10:30 session. Because we have a lot of very interesting talks with a lot of data in them, I'm not going to take the time to give appropriate introductions to my illustrious colleagues. Suffice it to say that you guys are in for a treat. These are really the four genetic syndromes that are closest to the point of translation. And these are really the four people in the world who are probably best suited to tell you about that. So I'm really excited for the panel, have been looking forward to it for some time. And with that said, I'm going to hand things over to Dr. Barry Gravis.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy. And I'm going to talk about Fragile X and the translational effort. And I want to thank the program committee and Jeremy for inviting me to come and tell the story of Fragile X, which has become a little bit of an epic. So hopefully I can get through that in the allotted time. And I always like to show this slide at the beginning of my talks with this guy with his, this is one of my Fragile X patients who just made his first model rocket. And I think what we're doing is really rocket science, and that's part of why it's been so difficult. And so with that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Fragile X syndrome and a little bit about the underlying mechanisms in the brain, and then I'm going to talk about the translational effort. So Fragile X syndrome is caused by a gene called FMR1, which has a CGG repeat sequence at the beginning of the gene. And in the normal situation, that CGG repeat is made into the RNA, but it's in the 5' untranslated region of the RNA, so it doesn't affect the protein exactly how long the sequence is. When there, you get little expansions of the gene in the 55 to 200 repeat range, the RNA contains a longer CGG repeat. The protein is made the same, but there are these toxic RNA molecules and some other molecules that build up and cause neurological disease later in life and early ovarian failure. And so those are premutation-related diseases that are considered Fragile X-associated disorders, but I'm not going to talk about them today. Fragile X syndrome is caused by what we call a full mutation, where the gene gets over 200 repeats, it's methylated, transcription is stalled, and we get no FMR1 RNA or a big reduction in FMR1 RNA, no Fragile X protein or a big reduction in protein. And as a result of the loss of FMRP, we have synaptic deficits and the intellectual compromise that goes along with Fragile X syndrome. The carrier state's usually passed in the family for many generations before you get Fragile X, and we have a simple DNA test to diagnose both Fragile X and the premutation carrier state. So Fragile X syndrome has a number of different features, some of which Jeremy pointed out in his last talk. And some patients have a very remarkable physical phenotype with sort of large prominent ears and a long face and a prominent forehead and jaw and midfacial hypoplasia. Many of the patients have hyperflexible joints and a large testes. Some of the patients really aren't too remarkable and you can't really see anything unusual in them, and some of them kind of look like Jeremy. You also get intellectual disability or learning disability in the vast majority of patients. The average IQ is about 40 or 50, and there's a decline with age during childhood. Motor coordination and praxis deficits, behavior problems are a big issue in people with Fragile X, anxiety being one of the biggest, and this is data from our forward data collection in the Fragile X Clinical and Research Consortium. Anxiety is probably the biggest problem. Attention problems, sensory problems, hyperactivity, aggression, and perseverative behaviors are all issues. And around half, as Jeremy mentioned, depending on what study you look at, meet the criteria for an autism spectrum disorder. Medically, we know that seizures are increased in this population at about 12%. Strabismus is a little higher. Frequent otitis media, GE reflux, sleep apnea, and loose stools. What we do in clinic is try to treat patients in a supportive fashion with therapy, educational strategies that are targeted to the way they think, medical interventions, behavioral interventions, psychopharmacology. And we have a Fragile X clinic at Rush since 1992 and over 600 patients. So we've done some studies on what kinds of medication treatments we've done. And what we can see is that about half the patients, based on clinical data, seem to be better when they're treated with these various agents like stimulants for attention and hyperactivity. If you try adjusting and use multiple medications, you can get to a little bit higher response rates. And again, these are clinical response rates, so they probably have a lot of placebo in them. Anxiety you can treat with SSRIs. Aggression you can treat with antipsychotics. And oversensitivity with alpha agonists. But if we really look at what's the efficacy, what do the families perceive about the efficacy of this behavioral treatment, we can see this is a family study I did with Don Bailey on medications. And so the blue people are the ones that, the green people are the ones that feel like their medication is working a lot. The red ones say, oh, it's working somewhat, and the blue ones say it's not working at all. So really the only thing we're really good at treating is seizures. All of the behaviors we take the edge off, but we don't do that well. And so there's clearly an unmet need for better behavioral treatments and for cognitive treatments, and of course that leads us to where we like to treat the underlying disorder. So we know that the fMRP level expression is related to the amount of disability, and this is certainly not a curve drawn to scale, but we know that when fMRP is very low, we get intellectual disability, and at various levels of fMRP, mainly studied in girls and mosaic males, you may have anxiety, ADHD symptoms, and learning disability when you have a mild decrease in fMRP. So we know that fMRP is important, and so what does it do? Well, we have a mouse to help us understand what fMRP does, and in this mouse, the FMR1 gene has been inactivated. It makes no active fMRP, and it has rather subtle, as Jeremy mentioned, but identifiable cognitive and social problems. It has audiogenic seizures when it's a young mouse, just like the kids with Fragile X have their seizures when they're in childhood. And it turns out when you actually look at the brain and the shape of the neurons and dendrites, it's a good neurobiological model to answer the question, what does fMRP do? So now I'm going to summarize papers and papers and papers of research in a few slides that describe what fMRP does. So fMRP, as Jeremy mentioned, is an RNA binding protein. It functions in a complex at the ribosome and regulates synaptic plasticity and the morphological maturation of dendritic spines. And it does that by regulating dendritic protein translation in response to synaptic activation. And it needs to be regulated very precisely for the synapse to mature correctly. So the fMRP, so when a synapse fires, one gets a change in the receiving synapse morphologically to become a stronger synapse or potentially a weaker synapse. And fMRP is in this protein complex at the dendrite that's helping those changes happen. And this is a picture from Gary Bissell that shows the fMRP at the dendrite, at the dendritic spine. And in fact, if we look at the Fragile X mouse, which Jeremy also showed you a similar picture, we can see that the dendritic spines are longer and more immature. We have the more immature kind in the Fragile X mouse. And this is also true in human Fragile X brain from the few autopsy samples that are available. So not only does fMRP regulate the morphologic appearance of the dendritic spines, it also regulates the synaptic strength. And so, again, Jeremy introduced glutamate receptors, and so the AMPA receptors are kind of the workhorse of the synapse, and the NMDA receptors are the depolarizing receptors, and then the regulatory receptors are the mGluR receptors. And so what Mark Baer found and Kim Huber in 2002 is that there's exaggerated mGluR-dependent LTP in the hippocampus in patients with Fragile X, and so there's not an adequate kind of synaptic strengthening. And it's also been found that AMPA receptors are excessively internalized, so you get this kind of weaker type of connection. There's reduced LTP in various areas of the cortex, and they're weaker and more immature synapses in general, physiologically. So these findings do vary from one brain region and one neuronal type to another, so it's very complex, and it depends on the form of plasticity that's expressed in any region. But even though it's very complex, one can create a simple model, and that's what Mark Baer attempted to do when he first discovered this, called the mGluR theory of Fragile X. So this is basically how the mGluR theory works in a cartoon. We've got the mGluR receptor here that's regulating the strength of the synapse and the number of AMPA receptors that are out there, and glutamate kind of hits that mGluR receptor all the time because the brain is bathed in glutamate, and the AMPA receptors can come in and out directly based on that interaction, but they also, if protein synthesis is activated, they can be internalized kind of permanently. And the way the protein synthesis is activated is the fMRP gets kicked off the ribosome, and it normally is inhibiting translation, and then one gets this extra boost of these proteins, and then that causes the AMPA receptor internalization. And one of the things that happens as a result of activation of this process is that fMRP itself is recruited back to the ribosome or back to the dendritic spine, and then one has kind of the break on the system, basically. And so in the normal situation, everything is kind of regulated based on how much synaptic activation there is. And in Fragile X, where we don't have fMRP, there's no fMRP here. And so these proteins are kind of made excessively constitutively. The AMPA receptors are internalized too much, and you get this weak, immature connection morphologically and physiologically. And there are quite a number of these individual proteins that have been shown to be increased in the brain of the Fragile X mouse. And then if you look at all of protein synthesis, this is just a PET scan of the Fragile X mouse, and you can see this is the control, and this is the Fragile X mouse. You get more protein synthesis in the Fragile X mouse due to the lack of fMRP. So that process doesn't go directly from the mGluR receptor to translation. It signals through a number of pathways that have turned out to be quite important in neurodevelopmental disorders. So you get signaling through an ERK pathway, an ERK-regulated pathway, and you also get signaling through the mTOR pathway, which I know that Mustafa is going to talk more about. And so, and this pathway involves a number of proteins regulating it that are involved in other diseases. In fact, some that are going to be talked about at this symposium. So all the proteins in yellow have been, or in orange rather, have been associated with some neurodevelopmental disorder or not. And you can see how they all interact with this pathway to regulate this protein translation system. So this is a key target for treatments of neurodevelopmental disorders, and treatments aimed at many of these targets within the signaling pathway as well as the mGluR receptor itself have reverse phenotypes in the fMR1 knockout mouse. Now, there's a number of different kinds of areas of target that we can go back to the simple model and look at the number of different kinds of targets we might have in Fragile X. So we might try to just block down activity at that mGluR5 receptor, and there's a number of drugs that do that. We might try to block one of those signaling pathways from the mGluR5 receptor to the ribosome that I just showed you, and there's a list of things that do that that have been studied. We might try to block some of these overactive proteins, and there's a list of things that have been explored to do that. We might try to activate the AMPA receptors or bring them back to the surface, and there's some drugs that do that. Or we might try to regulate the glutamate levels indirectly or the excitatory inhibitory balance with GABA or other agents, and there's a number of drugs that do that. Or we might, the fMRP actually regulates channel proteins directly through a direct physical interaction with them, and so also these channel proteins are overactive, and so one might think about a blocker for those channel proteins. So all of these treatments have been in basic science labs and explored in the Fragile X mouse, and many of them have shown reversal of different phenotypes. And it turns out that's fairly easy to do in the mouse. So now we're gonna look at some of what's going on in the human. So these are all proof of concept trials of targeted treatments that have happened in Fragile X, and Jeremy showed you a list of them. I'm gonna show you a little bit about what some of the results were. All of these agents have reverse phenotypes in the mouse. So CX516 is an AMPA activator. We used it in a clinical trial, one of the first clinical trials in Fragile X. It turned out it was too weak, and it really didn't have any effect except a suggestion of effect in the co-treated group with antipsychotics, which are known to amplify the effects of that drug. Lithium, which inhibits GSK3 beta and blocks PI turnover, and hence we thought would decrease the excessive signaling in the ERK pathway, improved behavior on an aberrant behavior checklist for 2 months and even for a year, improved an ERK activation biomarker, and improved verbal memory on the R bands. But again, this was an open label study, and we didn't go on with lithium because at the time things that we thought would have less side effects were actually emerging that worked on the mGluR5 receptor. Minocycline's been studied a lot by Rondi Hagerman. It blocks MMP9, which is a protein that's made to excess in the absence of fMRP, and she showed a little bit of improvement on a CGI, a normalization of MMP9 in the blood of the treated patients versus the placebo patients, and a normalization of auditory ERB habituation deficit in a subgroup of patients. Lovastatin inhibits ERK, and that came out in a paper from Mark Baer's lab. And so So Francois Corbin studied that and showed a behavioral improvement in an open-label study in people on lovastatin. And so this is open-label data, but so all the open-label studies work. But he did show that his ERK biomarker that he did in platelets, which was much better than the lymphocyte one that we have, actually correlated nicely with the behavioral improvement. So suggestive and needs more study. Acamprosate is a drug that Craig Erickson's been working on, and it's a GABA activator, and it proved social and hyperactive behavior in open label studies, and normalized an APP biomarker, because APP is another protein that's regulated by FMRP, and we have a placebo-controlled trial in progress with Craig right now. And then metadoxine, which works, again, on mechanism 4, this kind of working on possibly on GABA, and NNZ2566 from Neurin. Metadoxins from L-Cobra are both in progress in trials, and we'll see the results of those once they're analyzed. So now what I'm going to do is focus on the two sets of drugs that went the furthest in Fragile X trials. So our baclofen is one, and the mGlu5 blockers are the other. So our baclofen is a GABA agonist, and so it's known that GABA systems are abnormal in the Fragile X model mouse. Frank Cooey has studied this as well as others, and it's thought that there's an excitatory-inhibitory imbalance, much like it's thought in the autism field. GABA agonists rescue glutamate-induced lethality in the Fragile X fly. This is an easy phenotype to measure in Steve Warren's lab. And then baclofen rescued autogenic seizures in the Fragile X mouse. So Seaside picked up our baclofen and studied it as STX-209, and it's the more our baclofen is the more potent form of racemic baclofen. It's, again, a GABA-B activator, and it was shown to have pretty dramatic effects in the mouse. It reversed the excess protein synthesis. It reversed the excess AMPA receptor internalization. It normalized the dendritic spine density, and then it had a number of behavioral effects as well, and eliminated the audiogenic seizures. There have also been clinical anecdotes of patient improvement on baclofen, and so all of this data put together led to clinical trials of our baclofen. So what happened when we did clinical trials of our baclofen? Well, there was a phase 2 trial, which was a placebo-controlled crossover trial involving 63 patients, and what we saw in the primary analysis was that the visual analog scale, where the families rated the three worst behaviors their Fragile X child did, got significantly better, as did the social avoidance, but the primary outcome, which was irritability, didn't get better. And if you took out the more socially impaired group and this group that was diagnosed, or the group that was diagnosed with autism, you saw a more significant benefit of the R-baclofen versus the whole protocol group. So based on that, Seaside went into two phase 3 trials, one of which involved adults and adolescents, and in that, which was called 301, and there was no significant efficacy in 301. In 302, which was the 5 to 11-year-old group, the younger kids, that trial had to be stopped before it was finished because Seaside ran out of money. But basically, irritability on the ABC irritability scale was significantly better, as was the parenting stress index. But only in the group that was treated with the highest dose of R-baclofen. Originally, Seaside had wanted to do a flexible dose trial, and then the FDA mandated a fixed dose trial. Okay. The FDA mandated a fixed dose trial, and so it was really only the high dose group that showed the improvements and almost got the statistical significance for hyperactivity and social avoidance. So this looks like a drug that probably does have some effect. If you compare the effect size in that 5 to 11-year-old trial with that of most of the antidepressants that are FDA approved and on the market, the R-baclofen effect size is better to or similar to most of the FDA approved antidepressants. So we think R-baclofen actually works. We just need to find a way to do the right trial. In the FXCRC, we did an autopsy of where we compared the response in the drug responders and placebo non-responders, who then went on and had a response in the open label extension, versus the placebo responders, and showed that the patients who had a drug response had more areas of response, and there were some areas of response like coping, where we really weren't measuring that very well in our outcomes. So we don't think the outcomes were perfectly targeted to measuring the full R-baclofen response either. And this is actually a measure of mood and happiness, and it was much more of that in the drug responders than in the placebo responders. Another little interesting thing, and this of course needs more study, is that we have data from 30 of the patients on our baclofen who were in the extension, and now there is more data, but it's at the Simons Foundation. And so the social avoidance measures really stayed down for a year. And interestingly, on the Vineland, Alan Reese's group recently published a natural history of the Vineland that shows that the standard score goes down over time, and you can predict about how much down it will go in a year. And so these patients on our baclofen in daily living, communication, and socialization all showed either a steady score or a little bit of an increase in those Vineland scores as opposed to the trajectory that one would have predicted based on the community study. And this is reflected. This is one of my patients who literally tantrumed all the time. He couldn't get off the bus and go into the house. This is him after he ran a 5K and him after he went on Space Mountain at Disney World. And he was that way the whole time he was on our baclofen, and he went right back to his old self as soon as he came off of our baclofen. So I think there are some cases where we have where that's a drug that could bear more work. All right, now I'm going to shift and talk briefly about mGluR5 blockers. So mGluR5 blockers are probably the most studied drug in a developmental disability in history. The mouse phenotypes reversed is this big long list of morphologic, molecular, electrophysiologic, behavioral, social, and cognitive phenotypes. This is the reversal of the autogenic seizures by MPEP, which is an mGluR5 blocker. This is the reversal of the epileptiform bursts. This is the reversal that Jeremy showed you of the dendritic spine abnormality. And so all in all, the mGluR theory, there are 31 papers from 17 labs with about 90% of the phenotypes that were reported reversing. So there's a very large body of support for this mechanism, possibly more than any other one in the field. The phenotypes in the Fragile X fly, there are also four or five papers on the fly that show that courtship behavior, odor shock, and other memories reversed by mGluR5 blockers. And there's six phenotypes that Jeremy talked about that are reversed in the FMR1 knockout when it's genetically corrected by crossing to an mGluR5 heterozygous mouse. So what happened when we did trials of those drugs? Well, we did a nice phase one. Rondi Hagerman and I did a nice phase 1B open label trial where we gave a single dose of phenobarbital and showed that prepulse inhibition, which is about the only thing we could measure after one dose, actually normalized more than it did in test-retest controls. And then Novartis did a trial in Europe where they showed that there was a big reversal in behavior and normalization of behavior in patients who were the fully methylated patients in that group. But that was a small study, and that probably was a group effect. When we did big trials, i.e. Novartis did two large trials, one in adults and one in adolescents, there was a placebo run-in and then 3 months of treatment. The placebo group actually did better than the treated group in this trial, but you can see the placebo group was already doing better during the placebo run-in, so they were just a very suggestible group of patients. And then in adolescents, the placebo group was kind of right in the middle of the treated group. Roche did a similar study of their mGluR5 blocker, and again, this is the placebo group here, and these are the direct treated groups where we did not see any more improvement in anxiety over the 3 months of treatment in an adult and adolescent study. So the Novartis and Roche programs were disbanded, and so we are left with the question here of, okay, we treated adults and adolescents for 3 months. Do we think that's the same as treating the mouse for this very long time that Mark Baer treated it? Are you kidding me? Did we expect Fragile X to normalize in a 3-month treatment in a person that's been wiring their brain for over 12 years? So the big question is adult and adolescent behavior change in a 3-month period an adequate surrogate for synaptic plasticity reversal? And we think not. So we think the mGluR theory has possibly not been tested. So where are we in the Fragile X field? And this is a slide Jeremy made me make for the press conference, but then I thought I would use it here. So we have patients. We have a mutation, we have a protein that's missing, we have morphologic and electrophysiologic abnormalities, we have pathway abnormalities, we have drugs that target them, we have those drugs work in the mouse, they work in early phase trials, but they don't work in big trials. And so we are a little bit lost in translation right now, and we need to figure out ways to change trial designs and drug development to develop paradigms to bring these basic science findings to patients with Fragile X and other intellectual and developmental disabilities. So here I have a list of the quandaries that have come up, and again, we're talking about a big mismatch between basic science targets and patients. And so one issue is we have big placebo effects, and we need objective measures and biomarkers that translate from the animal model and are linked to clinical improvement. And I'm not going to list off all those, but this is what we've been working on since an outcome measures meeting at NIH in 2010 to try to develop better outcome measures. It's hard to pick the biggest thing that's going to improve one primary outcome based on animal studies, and so we need strategies to measure change across multiple domains that might improve in a developmental disorder. We have CONMED effects. We need ways to do studies off of meds. We're studying older patients. The shoe may have already dropped. We don't know how much those response those patients will have or how long it'll take to get the response, so we need to be able to go to a younger age with when patients are more plastic and earlier in the developmental progress. We may not see an effect unless we try to have people learn, so we need to find ways to embed a learning paradigm, and fMRP does a lot of things in the cell, so we may need eventually combinations of treatments that hit different parts of the mechanism. So I'm just going to show a few slides about the way we've been developing drugs and what we might need to do in the future. So right now what we're doing is we're doing early safety and exploratory studies in adults, and then we're doing phase 2 and 3 efficacy studies in adults for FDA approval, and then we're doing some PK in adolescents, and then we're doing an adolescent efficacy study, and then we're getting FDA approval, and then we're starting to think about kids, and we're doing a PK study in kids, and then we're doing some efficacy studies in kids, and eventually we might get approval in kids, and then post-marketing we would look at the long-term effects on cognition and development and how much did it really modify the disease. This is only going to work if you know the drug targets a particular behavior, not if you're going for disease modification. And I would argue that if you're going for disease modification, you've got to do it a little differently. You've got to do safety studies and look for biomarkers in adults and adolescents, do the early studies there, then translate that stuff to studies in children, and then do your efficacy studies in kids as young as you can get, targeting improvement for a developmental kind of indication. You need to do extended treatment studies to find out how much the drug really actually does work on the disease. Try to get FDA approval. And then eventually what we need to do post-marketing is go back and find out whether we can change adults and adolescents at all if we target their underlying disease that late and see how much we can change it. So this is a whole new way of thinking about it. And so we're thinking a lot about how to change that paradigm. And as a result, we've come up with a clinical trial that we're hoping Neuronext will eventually fund. And I've been working on this now for 8 months, and hopefully we're getting close to actually submitting it. So what we want to do is actually test the mGluR theory and all that preclinical animal model data that exists. And so we have a trial proposed for kids 3 to 6 because Novartis has PK data down to that young. We're going to randomize kids to drug or placebo, and then we're going to dose escalate them over 2 months so we have a good period of time to find their best dose to the highest tolerated dose. Then we're going to put in a language intervention for 6 months, and we're going to have both clinical and biomarker in the form of auditory ERP and eye tracking that we can monitor all along here as they go through the language intervention, so we can hook those biomarkers up to any kind of progress they make. And then at the end of 6 months, we do an assessment of the placebo versus the AFQ group, and then they all come up, they dose escalate again, and then they get 6 more months of treatment and extension for everybody, and that gives us a longer time to track some of these effects, as well as helping with recruitment. And so we have a study team, me and Walter, Craig Erickson, Randy Hagerman, and Len Abaduto and David Hessel, who've been working on design of this, and hopefully at some point it goes forward. I just want to mention that we do have a clinic consortium in Fragile X that helps with travel and distance for travel and the distance issues for a rare disease, and so patients have access to study sites. The FXCRC is also working on natural history through the Forward Registry and database funded by the CDC, and to have a natural history comparison group for long-term intervention studies. It's a mechanism to do research studies with sufficient patients across multiple sites, and it's functioning as a clinical trial consortium. And also it's working on optimizing and standardizing care delivery for Fragile X across the USA with best practices. And since the FXCRC has existed, we've seen a big increase in the number of study sites that we can have in any given trial. And then just one last thing I'm going to mention, that in the treating Fragile X has some relevance for autism, in that Fragile X, of course, has a clinical overlap with autism, but also a significant molecular overlap in that there's a lot of proteins in that mGluR to protein synthesis cascade that have been identified as causes of autism. There are quite a number of proteins that are regulated by FMRP. In fact, in some papers, up to a third to half of proteins that are identified in autism exome screens are proteins that are bound by FMRP. And then there's some GLUA-GABA overlap in terms of GABA pathways like neuroligand 3 regulating mGluR5 receptors that are involved in both disorders. And so finding a treatment, being successful in this treatment translation for Fragile X will certainly have some implications for autism and for other disorders. And I just want to thank, if anyone's not on this list, don't feel unhappy. We've collaborated with pretty much everybody that works on Fragile X. We've had funding from NIH, now the RDCRN, CDC, the John Merck Foundation, FRAXA, the National Fragile X Foundation, our local support group, as well as multiple clinical trial funding. And, it really takes a lot to move these efforts forward. And the most important group to thank are the Fragile X families, for whom we are trying to develop this treatment to improve their quality of life for their children. And that's all I'm going to say. Thank you.